Okay, well, I'm going to go on, move away from isotropic turbulence, which seems to have dominated the discussion so far, and talk about some of the recent simulations I've been doing. And the emphasis here won't be on the turbulence in this particular flow, but rather on some sort of limitations you run up against when you try and compute these things, and some things that may be of more general value to any turbulence simulation. But basically, I'll be talking about plane wakes subjected to successive irrotational strains. And I'll try and describe what that means in a little further. Basically, there are some old turbulence experiments where we looked at homogeneous turbulence and then through a distorting wind tunnel managed to examine the effects of strain on that homogeneous turbulence. And here we're looking at a similar thing, but instead of looking at strain on homogeneous turbulence, we're considering a wake, a plane wake flow. And this has also been done experimentally by putting a cylinder upstream of your straining duct of varying cross-section, and then studying how that impacts the wake evolution. And I've done several cases, 10 cases of that type. And today I'm talking about some other ones which are follow-on to that, where instead of just applying one strain through one sort of distorting duct section, you then follow on with a different distorting duct section. And I'll have a schematic to hopefully make that clearer further on. I start with two different strains and then apply a sequence of a total of three different types, and I'll sort of show what that looks like and the motivations for doing that. So take a look at the motivations and objectives here. Well, there are a lot of simulations of isotropic turbulence, homogeneous shear turbulence. We've seen some of the results of those. Bob and I have been working for many years on free shear flow turbulence, mixing layers and wakes, and you've seen some reference to those flows that we've generated. This is sort of an effort to try and add one more level of complexity and basically look at then a flow that not only has the shear associated with a wake that can provide a production, but also some extra strain, which then would put some direct energy into the turbulence by the direct straining. And really then you have two competing production mechanisms in the flow, one from the shear of the wake and one from the applied strain. Now, this is really motivated by a spatially developing problem, which is analogous to the time-developing turbulence being strained, and that is wakes in an adverse pressure gradient. And so here's a schematic from a paper by Smith showing a high-lift airfoil with multiple components, the main element, and then different components before and aft that move down to get the high-lift configuration. And what they've found here is that if you have some wake coming off of one component, because it's going into an adverse pressure gradient, the wake actually gets deeper, and you can get actually wake bursting, where the deficit is greater than the free stream velocity, and a bunch of other things which are not good for high lift airfoil performance. And so we want to try and understand a little bit about what is the impact of this, in this case, the adverse pressure gradient on the wake, or for the analogous problem in the time developing problem, which we're in some kind of a reference frame moving with the mean flow and watching what the strain does to us, where we can view that adverse pressure gradient like an extra strain on the flow.
The pressure gradient
is it turns out I've tried to do all sort of orientations of the strain. The ones I'm going to talk today about are analogous to adverse and favorable pressure gradients. Okay, then also here, sensitivity of the results to different initial conditions. That's something that now can be addressed by these new cases. The initial cases that I looked at all began from the same initial turbulent state, which was from our unstrained wake computations. I took a flow field from that computation that was in the self-similar regime and suddenly applied a strain. So for instance, in this case, I have what I call C-type straining, which is analogous to an adverse pressure gradient. You're kind of squeezing the flow in the streamwise direction and letting it expand in the cross-stream direction. And so I had previously then this case C simulation, which took the wake, some plane wake, and did that kind of a distortion to it. So these new cases that I'll be talking about today then not only run case C and run it even further than shown here, but then at some point stop, reverse the sign of the strain, so you have a favorable pressure gradient. So in fact, by this point, you have a total strain of 1, and you're back to the sort of kind of size, any sort of box of turbulence that's been squeezed by the strain has been squeezed back to its initial size. And then I've applied to actually run this case out further or also restrained it with type C, which means we can compare this type C strain on whatever the initial turbulence is here with the type C strain on whatever it was back there. And similarly, done a sequence of simulations where we can have the favorable pressure gradient type analog applied first, followed by then adverse straining and again favorable straining. Okay, before we get into the results of these new cases, let me just highlight what we found by looking at just straining the wake, so just looking at the first chunk of wind tunnel on there, one thing that pops out of all the simulations is that the shape of the mean velocity deficit is very near universal. Most unstrained wakes are Gaussian but decay slightly faster at the tails. What we find is no matter how you strain it with any axis of orientation, you still get that same profile, mean profile, that you see in the unstrained wake. So a wake seems to be very insensitive. A deficit is always of that kind of a shape. And some analysis shows that that actually has some ramifications on the Reynolds number of the wake. In particular, for a certain time evolution of the strain, we can actually predict how this product of the wake deficit and the wake half-width is going to evolve. However, if you look further into the things, in other words, not just at the mean profile, but in Reynolds stress profiles and other indicators, what you find is that the flows are not in some kind of a fully self-similar equilibrium. In other words, there are still sort of evolution changes in time of the relative importance of the different terms. However, from the computations, we have been able to come up with a couple of rules of thumb for the evolution of these two quantities, and the evolution is different than that predicted by the self-similar solution that does exist. In particular, what we find is that the width of the wake, instead of following the self-similar solution, seems to eventually follow just the sort of global straining. If you're pulling on it in Y at a certain rate, then the width of that wake will eventually follow that same spreading rate. If you squeeze on it, the wake, instead of being squeezed out of existence, will eventually tend to go to a constant width. And if you don't squeeze in that cross-stream direction, the wake width tends to go just like that of the unstrained case. So we see these behaviors, which are not in accordance with the self-similar solution, but the computation does provide that insight, how that behaves. Another thing that's observed from these cases is that the turbulence cannot keep pace with the mean flow changes. In other words, if we see a change in the wake deficit, some increase of the velocity deficit UM, the turbulence fluctuations don't scale like the square of that deficit anymore. They can't go as fast as the changes in the mean flow caused by the strain. Previously, all the cases were begun from one initial condition, but with these successive strains, we actually can see how the straining affects the turbulence starting from different conditions. And one thing that we've looked at is this issue of what's important in this flow, the total amount of strain that the flow is seeing, how important is the strain rate at which it was applied, and does the strain history matter at all? And of course, these cases have a strain history that's pretty interesting. You know, we'll do a certain amount of favorable followed by a certain amount of adverse strain, end up with zero total strain, and the question is, well, right. Okay. Yeah, let me see here if I have a slide, numerical method, put some details there. I don't want to go. Okay, the initial condition is a developed self-similar wake flow. So the remnants of boundary layer turbulence have disappeared. There is viscous diffusion is not important in this flow. They're all direct numerical simulations of the incompressible Navier-Stokes equations. Like I mentioned, we're in a temporally evolving reference frame. So some kind of thing advecting with the flow, that's for computational convenience. We can achieve higher Reynolds numbers. Using a pseudo-spectral numerical method, the strain, the global straining, is handled by the Regalo transformation that allows us to use the spectral method in this. We basically are in a moving coordinate system where the computational box is being distorted by the global applied strain. And we combine that with a method developed by Javier Jimenez for treating the far field potential tails that go off to infinity, essentially. So it's sort of a hybrid scheme of previously developed methods for different flows. Computationally, these take on a crazy 90 anywhere from 40 to 165 hours for each run. And in this case, the initial conditions we'll be using will be not only that initial unstrained field, but the results of the previous simulations.
What is the aspect ratio?
The initial computational domain, the way we started the initial unstrained wake computation was to take a boundary layer computation from Philippe Spillart, and the aspect ratio there was about four times as long in X as it was in Z. And of course, we simulate the full extent in Y. So if you squeeze an X, you actually can squeeze quite a bit before you get to the Z size of the domain. But one of the limitations of these kind of problems is since you are squeezing in certain directions, then eventually you do become box size limited. And that, you'll have sample problems associated with that.
And when it is more squeezed, how large is the bandwidth compared to, let's say,
Well, I actually run to a total strain of 10 for the first cases, but by there, some of them are for surely impacted. When I start the different kind of strain here, it was at a dimensionless time of 1.4, so it would be e to the 1.4, about a factor of 3.5 or 4 or something. So that some of the strain geometries, it doesn't matter. In fact, I'll show a slide from that in a second here. But so several of the simulation issues that go through these flows, first of all, are they sensitive to different initial conditions? The previous simulations we did of free shear flows showed that the evolution throughout the computation was sensitive to different things you can do in the initial conditions, different kinds of forcing. So these flows seem to maintain sort of remnants of the initial conditions in them. And the question is here, well, if we strain now this other flow,
that how many editors or times or something like that would you have taken?
Well, in terms of the mixing layers that we've studied, you know, once you're in the self-similar regime, we get maybe a doubling of the width, or something like that. So there,
this particular one,
the wake. For the forced wake, you know, we have actually an unforced case and two forced cases, and they sustain these different growth rates basically as long as we can run the computation, which is not a huge length of time compared to experiments. And it is possible that you would say, well, maybe later it would relax back to some universal rate.
How many, say, the D by U units are something comparable, or delta by U or delta by delta?
In terms of turbulent length scale, well, again, you have this problem that the things are continually changing as they develop in time, but the wakes increase by maybe a factor of, you know, two or three, again, once they're in a self-similar period. So it's not a huge range, but we have done one thing to address that, and that is to do large eddy simulations of the same thing, which we can run much longer in time. And those seem to show that the growth rates that we observe through the DNS are sustained at longer times.
Mm-hmm. There's a couple of nice papers Mike and co-authors have appeared recently.
Another thing here, this issue of box size limitations and statistical sample, that comes up strongly, especially in this case, because of the straining. And for some particular orientations of the strain, you're rapidly losing computational box as you squeeze on that, which means your statistics are going to take a hit. And I guess I'll just show quickly an example of that. This is from the previous case where we're just doing strains of different orientations, and the strain that's being applied is shown in red. Where you can see if you squeeze in the homogeneous plane and pull in it, then your sort of sample area, your size of your plane stays constant. And for those two strains, your statistics are okay. In the cases where Z is unstretched but X is becoming bigger, then you're actually getting a bigger and bigger homogeneous plane to sample over, and your statistics become quite smooth. For the cases, however, where you're squeezing in one direction, not expanding the other, your plane that you're averaging over gets smaller, and you can see that by total strain of 10, your statistics are very noisy and showing, you know, problems with the sample. So these are plots of the energy balance for the Q-squared balance, so the turbulent kinetic energy balance. There are different production mechanisms, and as you vary through the wake profile, so this is just a profile through the wake. And the point of this is not to look at the details of the turbulent energy balance, but just the fact that you can see how the problems of the shrinking computational domain size are making it tough to evaluate the results from a couple of the orientations of the strain.
What's the straining time roughly compared to
the initial straining time is on the order of the turbulent time scale Q squared over epsilon. Okay, so let me put this one back up here. One thing that was observed in these early simulations is that they don't follow the mathematical self-similar solution that exists. So again, that's another complication in terms of trying to get some guidance there. The turbulence is not in equilibrium with the mean flow, and in fact, in keeping with some of the experimental work results that we're seeing, it seems almost that the strain, you can explain the effect on the turbulence better through an RDT kind of mechanism, a rapid distortion theory, rather than on some kind of equilibrium arguments. Okay, so just get a physical picture here of what these flows look like. This is contours of spanwise vorticity, and this is the initial unstrained wake computation. That's the initial condition. If you apply the strain, an adverse pressure gradient type strain, in other words, you're squeezing the flow like that and letting it spread out in Y, or actually stretching it in Y, but you can see then, of course, you're losing computational domain size in X, and the wake width increases exponentially because of the exponential sort of pulling associated with the constant strain. On the other hand, if you squeeze in Y and pull out in X, you don't have any problems with domain sample size. In fact, your profiles get very smooth, but you see sort of a very different behavior. And so for the successive strain computations, this is the initial condition before applying then a favorable type pressure gradient, stretching it back to this sort of scale. And this one then will be then squeezed adversely. And
that's when you get the noisy statistics when you're having...
This one gives noisy statistics, right. And so the successive cases then, if you take that case C and you then squeeze it back out like this, you can see you recover the original box size, but the character of the turbulence has kind of changed. You have a much sort of wider wake. And then you can again, at this point, apply again the squeezing this way, and that's what's seen here. You bring it back to something that looks somewhat similar to that initial condition in terms of the turbulence in there. Now, if you go through your other tunnel where you start with that D strain first, you remember we had a sort of a long, thin string of stuff. If you then squeeze that now, what you see is sort of a buckling of the thing that gets quite severe. Here now you're back to the initial box size again, but awake it's much wider. In other words, what you see here, that to first order the turbulence is being just sort of passively stretched and squeezed by the straining and isn't really having time to react to that and come into any kind of equilibrium. If you then squeeze back with this favorable type gradient, you stretch it out again. So this is just to get a feel for what the turbulence looks like for some of these plots. Okay, I just want to quickly mention a little bit about the mathematical self-similar solution that does exist for this case. I mentioned before that the mean velocity deficit profiles are self-similar, and because they have this universal shape that's roughly like Gaussian, you can come up with an analytical expression for the product of the velocity deficit and the wake width. And for a constant strain in time, the kind that we're considering here, what you see is that product must go exponentially, like the applied strain in the cross-stream direction, minus the component in the streamwise direction. If you take the other sort of governing equations that you have and do the same kind of analysis that Bill did, sort of saying, well, all these terms should come into balance with each other, what pops out at the bottom then is that the product of these two scale like that, the self-similar solution says that each individual one takes half of that difference, accounts for half of it, so that the sort of the growth rate and the deficit and the width should be equal, share that total amount equally. And what that corresponds to is then the shear, the velocity over the width of the wake, being constant. And intuitively this makes sense, because if you have a constant applied strain and you want to come into some kind of self-similar equilibrium, then you'd expect that the wake shear would also have to come into some constant equilibrium so that those two production mechanisms with the shear and the strain could become of comparable importance.
Excuse me, I am a little confused.
Okay.
The width of the wake would grow, whereas the deficit will actually reduce with time.
Not with the strain. And it turns out, for instance, for the adverse pressure gradient case, right. Yeah, this is the total... Right, constant strain.
It depends on what sort of strain you have.
That's right. What actually happens depends on the orientation of the strain. But for the adverse pressure gradient case, for instance, the deficit increases exponentially, so you get some weird behavior there. The other thing that pops out of the analysis of all the equations is that the Reynolds stresses should scale like the deficit squared, which is sort of a classical self-similar type solution, and the anisotropies should be constant. In other words, there should be kind of structural equilibrium in the turbulence where all the different components have the same relative amount of the turbulent kinetic energy, and that increases or decreases in accordance with the wake deficit.
Yes, that's the equation I have. Mm-hmm. Mike and I have been debating this for some time,
because
I don't know any other
calls for this trip. Right. Yeah. So Bill feels there may be a more general solution to this, and that would be interesting.
Furthermore, Mike, when you say it makes sense to have a shear that remains constant, you gave some argument which I am not quite...
Well, I don't say it makes sense physically. I'm saying that if there was a self-similar evolution, if you were to achieve a self-similar evolution, it makes sense that those two effects would have to come into balance. Otherwise, one of them would become negligible compared to the other.
This is constant shear again, right?
Constant strain. Constant strain, right. Mm-hmm. It turns out you can do the analysis for time-varying strains, and then the same thing happens. The wake shear takes on the same time variation as the applied strain. They have to still come into balance.
The alternative would be for one to become
negligible. That's what I'm saying. And then you don't have a strained wake anymore. Right. So this is just an example of the mean velocity profile, and these are the C-type cases, case C, case DC, and CDC, and case D, CD, and DCD. And you can see that, again, all the mean profiles always look like this Gaussian. The dashed line is a Gaussian, but slightly faster decay at the tails. The exception is this case here, but if you look at what happens for this type of strain, the deficit is dropped to three orders of magnitude less than the initial value, and basically you just have, you know, noise here at this point. The deficit has been wiped out by the straining. Okay, so we can look at that first relationship that we got analytically here. The fact that all those mean profiles collapse means that you can prove this. In other words, the product of the deficit and the width should go exponentially like that, and here is the result from all the simulations. And you can see there is very good agreement with this relationship because there is very good collapse of those profiles. Basically, the chain dotted curve is the unstrained wake, and it comes into a self-similar equilibrium where that Reynolds number is constant. That's the classical solution for an unstrained wake. If you apply the adverse pressure gradient type strain, you see the exponential increase predicted by the sign of the strain. If you reverse the sign for a favorable type pressure gradient, you see the exponential behavior there. But then, if at this total strain of about 4, you flip the sign, you come right back up to the same position, which looks exactly like where you started with the unstrained wake. And continuing on DCD, by then at this point applying a C-type strain, you can see that the trajectory exactly matches CD, and they overlap. And conversely, this one, CDC, exactly overlaps DC. So there is no hysteresis, no history of the strain effects. The only thing that matters here is the total strain. If you know what the total strain is, you can exactly know where you're going to be on this plot. And the reason that works is because the mean profile is so insensitive to any kind of straining or pressure gradient that you can do to it. Right. Well, this is just for this property here, and it's directly linked to the insensitivity of a mean profile. Let's take the next step and look not at the product of those two things, but look individually at the width and the deficit. And what we see here is that there are strain history effects. You can see that the turbulence is having an impact. Here's your wake width for the unstrained case, e to the 1/2, as expected by the classical self-similar solution. But when you apply any of these C-type adverse pressure gradient strains, you can see that ultimately the wake width increases exponentially, whereas when you flip the sign in the favorable one, you're squeezing on it, eventually the wake width comes to about a constant, somewhat less convincingly a constant for these cases where the wake is almost completely wiped out, again, three orders of magnitude below in the deficit. So it appears then that we are following the self-similar solution in terms of this behavior for this case, which it was predicted to go to e to the at, although other statistics show it's not completely self-similar. But here you can see it makes a very big difference if we do a C strain followed by a D strain or a D strain followed by a C strain. Both of these have a total strain of 0, but they're at quite different widths and a quite different deficit associated with those. So for these quantities, it does make a difference. That's right. If you do the same plot, in fact, I have cases that I varied the strain rate by a factor of 4 slower and faster. And what you find there is that, let me put that up. These are cases where you vary the strain rate. Again, this case C type geometry. So you can see the unstrained wake, as you increase the amplitude of the straining, you increase the Reynolds number more rapidly, you spread the wake more rapidly, and the deficit increases more rapidly. But if you plot those instead of against time, if you plot those quantities against the total strain, then this product, all the curves exactly collapse. And even the other curves do a reasonable job of collapsing, except for the slowest case against the total strain there. One thing that's interesting, though, is that the relative wake shear ratio to the applied strain A, although it does come into equilibrium for this case, as predicted by the self-similar solution, the ratio of them is different for the different initial conditions. So again, here you're seeing some kind of effect where, yes, an equilibrium is achieved, but that equilibrium is different depending on the initial conditions.
Is there any threshold strain where you start getting the
significant deviation? Right. If you went low enough, you figure eventually it would have to become negligible. So there must be eventually, you must be able to go back all the way towards this unstrained case. And that basically...
In
in a linear fashion? I think it's totally gradual. I mean, you can see that here. In some sense, these are already at the rapid limit, and there isn't much difference anymore. But this is 1/4 of that strain rate. Presumably, as you keep lowering it, you know, you would see that just fan out. I don't think it's a threshold type of phenomenon.
And just to be sure I understand, for the Reynolds number, the BU.
This one here.
Mm-hmm. Now, that actually is an analytic result given the universality
right. of the mean profile. Exactly. Exactly. If you have that universality, this has to happen, and indeed it does.
Yeah, but you know, you pointed out that the mean profile collapses almost perfectly no matter what.
Right.
There's no way that can happen if the Reynolds stress profile is not also collapsing, because those are the only two terms in the equation. So if yours isn't, that says you're scaling wrong. In other words, remember the weight that you involved in Dan Ewing did. The scale for the Reynolds stress was not US, it was USD.
Right. Right.
And I'll bet you the same thing's happened here, because somehow the Reynolds stress has absorbed that difference. Otherwise, those profiles can't be the same.
Well,
so I bet you. I bet you at dinner.
Write that down.
It's being recorded.
Okay, that's right. So this is, again, one more plot looking at the ratio, then, of U and B. So this is the weight shear relative to the applied strain rate, which for these cases is all the same. A is just constant but of different sign. And what you can see is the C-type straining, the adverse gradient, you do get this constant shear, so it looks like the self-similar solution might be holding. But in the D-type strain, you don't, and what you observe is the wake deficit decays exponentially fast to the point where really the wake is negligible here, and you just have a straining flow of some kind of interface of turbulence. Okay, and look quickly now at some turbulence quantities. Here is the quantity turbulent kinetic energy normalized by this exponentially varying wake deficit. And what you can see is you get very rapid growth of this when the wake deficit is decaying and very rapid decay when it's increasing. And what that's telling you is this scaling is not a good way to collapse the data. In fact, if you just to look at Q squared with just the initial value normalizing it, you can see the range of variation of this quantity is really not that much. It's within or two orders of magnitude here instead of the 8 you've created by that. What that's saying is, no, the turbulence is not tracking the deficit at all. It's roughly constant and, you know, slightly impacted by what the deficit does to the strain. But it's much slower than the effect on the mean profile, and it can't keep pace with that. Here's the turbulence time scale, and you can see a similar kind of behavior. So the turbulence time scale, and I guess, Bill, you were just asking about this, Q squared over epsilon normalized by the strain, for all the cases pretty much increasing, not all that different from what's observed in the unstrained wake case at roughly the same rate. Of course, there are these temporary changes as the strain is applied. And comparing that turbulence time scale then to the wake shear, you can see again that the wake shear disappearing in the D-type strains, taking it off and slowly increasing with C. So again, the
ratio is about 10?
Which over...
Turbulence time scale...
This one on the right, the turbulence time scale compared to the wake shear, yeah, starts on the order of, the unstrained wake, it drops down to about, I guess that's 5, and then it'll increase in the C-type straining and decrease rapidly with the D-type straining. Okay, so the question is, well, the C-type case, at least the shear is going to a constant. In other words, the deficit is increasing exponentially, but the width is increasing exponentially also, and you maintain a constant shear and you have a constant strain. So the hope is, well, maybe that one could establish some type of self-similarity. And so these are the Reynolds stress anisotropies and the evolution in time. And what you can see here then, this is case C. Case C then, all these C-type cases, the straining, you have two different production mechanisms here. In the U squared component, you have production from A11. And the V squared is production from A22, and the sign of that changes with the sign of the strain, whether it's a D-type or a C-type strain, whereas the shear production is just production in U2. The solid line is the anisotropy associated with U, and you can see for this first case it's not constant, but it isn't too bad. For the other type cases where you flip the strain, in other words, you initially brought it up, killed the U-type energy in D, if you then suddenly flip the strain, it jumps back up, created by the strain there. If you flip it again, it jumps back down to essentially zero energy in that component. Here again, this C-type strain, what you see, the strain rapidly sort of brings this anisotropy so that the U has a huge amount and the V squared is depressed, just like you'd expect from those production terms. So you can see that instead of a self-similar evolution where these are constant, and although this one gets somewhat close to that, you can see the strain is really dominating the flow for these other cases.
It wouldn't be hard to imagine those are settling into a constant column, at least all of them, but the one in the bottom lower corner, right? Well, I guess those bottom two.
Yeah, well, there's some, you know, this one completely kills all the energy in that component. One other way to look at this production by the strain is looking at the ratio. And if you look at then the ratio of the production of Q squared by strain to that by shear, so you can see your shear production, the strain production, in addition to the value of the strain, it has an anisotropy measure there. And, of course, in the case where the wake deficit decays, all the D-type cases, the dashed lines, this is going to zero, so you expect that ratio to go through the roof, and it does. But the remarkable thing is that even the KC-type strain here, even though that this comes into balance with A, both of these are constant, that the anisotropies keep changing such that the production by the strain gets continually stronger. And you see that again in this case here, and even more remarkably here. Here, this case was initially had positive production by the strain, but then you suddenly flip the sign of the strain that actually kills turbulence energy, but very rapidly the anisotropy flips back the other way, so you cross through zero, and the strain production again dominates. So it seems that eventually, even in cases where the shear comes into balance with the strain, the production by the strain tends to make the flow, you know, depart from self-similarity, at least for the strain rates looked at here. Okay, so finally, I just put up a few conclusions. First of all, the rules of thumb for how the width and the deficit evolved that we got just from looking at the cases that all began from that one particular realization of an unstrained wake seem to still be valid in these cases with successive strain. So there isn't a huge sensitivity to the sort of initial condition in terms of the qualitative behavior of their evolution. The evolution's still not self-similar, and I guess Bill mentions there may be another self-similar state maybe that could describe this, but in terms of that simple solution with constant anisotropies, that's not what we see happening here. The turbulence cannot keep pace with the mean flow changes, even though the time scale associated with the strain is of the same order of the turbulence. The BIJs are not in constant. There's no equilibrium. By looking at these plots against strain rate, we can assess sort of the importance of strain rate and by the successive strains of strain history. And what we seem to be seeing is that for these strain rates, even though they're rather modest, that the strain eventually dominates the character of the computations and prevents the self-similar type state from being achieved. Are there any questions on that?
I have two questions. How large is AT after
T equals 10 or so? AT got up to 10, I guess. The 10. E to the AT gets up to 10. So. No, E to the AT is up to 10, sorry. Right. So the most that I've ever strained is taking the box from 100 units down to 10 units, basically. It's a total. Right. And for these cases with the successive strains, I change it at 1.4, actually.
My second question is, how large was more the minimum wave number and maximum wave number and the energy peak wave number? Could you give me?
I don't have the spectra here, but I guess the small scale resolution is pretty good, and you can see that by looking at the contour plots of the vorticity.
Could you give me the number? The minimum wave number, so you deform 10 times or so.
Right.
My concern is what is the effect of the cutoff at low K and large K?
Right. Off the top of my head, I don't know what those numbers would be, but I can tell you by looking at the plots, you know, you can get an idea that the small scale resolution is still quite good because there's no ring. This is a spectral method in the vorticity contours. Right. And in fact, for these flows, RDT might be a very good way of checking it, because they do the leading order effect seems to be these strain induced things and not the turbulence nonlinear interactions. It depends. It's continually remeshed to account for the squeezing. So the direction that's squeezed, eventually you'll be reducing grid points. The direction that's stretched, the longest stretch domain was up to 1,500 points or something. So I continually monitor the small scale resolution and add points as needed to make sure it's still resolved.
Why should you think a self-similar solution in a problem like this?
Well, that's a good question. There's no...
Surprise,
Well, I guess Bill is surprised that it isn't. So there's differing opinions there.
Well, not
right. Right. I guess there mathematically there is a self-similar solution. So the question, and in fact, the early experiments that did it in wind tunnels were trying to see if experimentally they would get that self-similar solution, and they didn't either. They got behavior similar to what I'm observing here. Certainly, you have two different competing production mechanisms, and the thought that those could all come into balance with the dissipation and everything may be a bit too much to ask, and that seems to be what's happening.
Two competing production mechanisms are the strain.
Right, and the shear associated with a wake deficit.
It's a wonderful example, at least the earlier study, a multi-point similarity solution, because it really did a wonderful job of explaining the spectra and the cross-spectra, and some of the legal features. In particular, it was able to show when the calculation was probably beginning to break down because of box size. And I thought, that was really a nice feature of how you mix theory and DNS mix in the paper. Is it with this bullets or GFM?
The JFM weight paper, yeah.
But
is not in there yet. In fact, well, is that, what's the status on that? It's still...
If you want to pound on Dan...
Yeah, Dan.
But,
so,
well, I guess the... what seems to be is that a very little mid amount of strain can cause a lot of problems in terms of taking your turbulence and making it a non-equilibrium type turbulence. And that has big implications for turbulence modeling, in that just knowing the mean flow is not going to tell you a whole lot about the turbulence. It's going to be dominated. Right. Right. Right, and seems to be confirming that. Right. Right.
The fact that you get a Gaussian must help somewhere or another. Can that be of help?
Well, it's not quite Gaussian. What helps is that it's a universal shape, and that's observed. Right. That's seen in experiments with pressure gradients and all kinds of things. They always get that. So the deficit has a pretty universal shape, and that does help. And here, in terms of, I can nail the product of the deficit in the width. So if I get a rule of thumb for the width, I can tell you what the deficit is based on that, knowing what the product is.
I know that you're calculating this for a flow which is two-dimensional in the mean using Cartesian coordinates. Would the main conclusion like those on the last slide hold for a systematic width also?
I haven't done the analysis to see, you know, how that equation would become modified. Presumably, if you had a universal shape, which you probably would, there would be some analogous relationship between the product and the width. It presumably wouldn't be the same one, though, because there would be, you know, some factor or some power in there. But I would suspect that, you know, you'd see similar kinds of behaviors for the axisymmetric case as well.
An axisymmetric wake eventually decays
unless you apply a strain. Yeah. Right.
Mike, in the earlier simulation, if you continued the calculation, eventually you started to see real pronounced 2D structures. Do you see any evidence of that?
Well, again, that depends on the sign of the strain. For the flows where you squeeze it and pull it in Z in the span, then you see this coalescing of like-sign vorticity. And right. But if, on the other hand, if you stretch it in Y, you see this profusion of small scales and no real large-scale organization, and also a kind of a dead zone that develops in the middle where the turbulence is actually dying out, and you just have these sort of turbulent layers separating from each other. So you can see really different behavior depending on the orientation of the strain.
Systematic weights can actually provide for miles and miles, maybe 5-10 miles.
Right, and presumably by adding some strain on it, you could keep it alive even further.
It's arguable, but it apparently goes down like x to the minus a third.
Well, and the strain, I mean, these adverse pressure gradient strain cases, the deficit actually increases. So if you had an adverse pressure gradient on that, it would feed back in to increase the deficit. So.
I was looking through Jim Rice's research, and I was going to ask. I don't know how, just looking.
See if I give him my stuff.